Good morning, everyone. We have a full room and we are on time.
Why don't we start with introductions? Welcome, everybody. For once, we're here on a beautiful sunny day, and the rivers are down. Good day. I'm Joan Burke from the Lakes and Fishes.
Bill Moulton, I'm your secretary.
My name is Emily Bender. I'm with the Sacramento LGBT Community Center.
Welcome, Emily. This is your first
seat. All right, welcome. Dan Monk, Sacramento Police Department.
Diane Lampe, Sacramento County Office of Education.
Todd Henry, Sacramento Sheriff's Department.
Sarah Montrager, City of Elk Grove.
Emily Hopkins, City of Sacramento.
Charles Ware.
David Houston, Cottage Housing.
John Foley, Sacramento South Elk Housing.
Jason Henry, Veterans Resource Centers of America.
Erin Johansson, TLCS.
Nick Lee, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Michelle Webb, Sacramento
Steps Forward.
Michelle
Rosenwald,
next
note.
Kate Hutchinson, LSS.
Susan Johnson, Midwest Services.
Wendy Martins, Mercy Housing.
Jen Fleming, Mercy Housing.
Mike Jaffe, Sacramento Ed.
Jeremy
Sarah Ansis with Home Base.
Jason Greenlow with Home Base.
Hope Andrew Gerkes, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Gabrielle Salazar, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Mara Renteria, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Kimberly Peterson with Sacramento Steps Forward.
I'm Kathy White with the County Office of Ed.
Terry Light with the Housing Project.
Nick Morris, Sacramento County Public Health.
Lacey Nicholas with Charles School of Law.
Christy Gonzalez, Wells Space Health.
Will Haley with Charles School of Law.
Lisa Culver with Empowerment. Getting tea, sorry. Very important. The minutes?
The minutes are in your packet. And went out online. We would entertain a motion to accept the minutes. We have a motion to accept.
Second.
We have a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries.
Chair's report. Well, I am in an exceedingly optimistic frame of mind this morning because Measure H passed in Los Angeles.
You're here.
With more than a two-thirds majority, and it is a 25-cent sales tax that can be used for homeless services, housing subsidies, and it's substantial enough to make a huge difference in LA. And as we know, they passed a $1.2 billion housing bond for homeless housing last fall, and so this just gives them the tools they need to really address homelessness. And Mayor Garcetti really championed this, along with business and the local United Way and healthcare and others. Mayor Garcetti was just reelected in a landslide. So I think it gives encouragement to all of us as we look for ways to address homelessness, and maybe especially to the cities who are looking for ways to address it. It really is an amazing day. So it's good to be here working on it here in Sacramento today. Right.
Looking forward to it. I think I'm waiting to see how things play out with the county and the city with their plans and recommendations that can come back from SHRA. So I'm in the same boat as everyone else. And how that plays out.
So
we've got a
pretty
rich agenda, so
just move on. Okay. Let's see where we are. Program award scores.
I wanted to update the advisory board on our performance on the fiscal year 2016 continuum of care application. That's the community application component of the annual competition, so what we submit alongside all of the project renewals and new project applications. And that's something that our staff works pretty hard on every year. And I'm very pleased to report that our score, which was 164.75 out of 200, exceeded the median score and the weighted median score. We exceeded the median score by not quite 10 points, and by the related median by not 5 points. This translated directly into new project funding for our community. We gained about $777,000 in new project funding in this cycle, and HUD specifically said, you know, communities that scored above that weighted mean are the ones that earned additional funds instead of losing funds, which is what happened to the rightly scored being lower. So, we did score above the average last year as well, although not quite as much. And we'll continue to work to improve that score. HUD, we've talked here previously about the fact that HUD doesn't give us a lot of information about how we did on each question. The results of this year's application score were similar. So we got scores by the four main sections. And so we're able to take a look and see where we did better or worse in chunks. And we'll try to figure out where we can improve, read the TV's a little bit on that. But thank you to all the Sacramento Steps Forward staff and the community members that have done all the hard work that we were able to write about this application.
So is there a way to give us an email today or no? Four chunks and kind of where we scored higher this time?
I can tell you what we scored on each section, but I don't have that against the other communities. But I do have those scores. We scored our best section, which has been the case for multiple years now, is our data collection and quality, so everything we do in HMIS. And that was 27 points possible, which we earned 26 points. So that's a lot of that is thanks to Manjeev, but also to every user of the HMIS who pays attention to keeping their missing data low and really attending to that factor. Part one of the application is called COC Structure and Governance. So that includes this advisory board, its structure, and our committee structure, things like that. There were 51 points possible there, and we scored 44.25. And I should say anywhere from 10 to 20 individual questions and sub-questions even each of these parts. And we spoke to data quality and collection. Under COC performance and strategic planning, we earned 77.5 out of 101 points.
Ooh, that doesn't sound so good.
Some of that actually has to do with our not yet turning the curve, let's say, on veteran homelessness or chronic homelessness. HUD does score communities on decreasing those populations, which of course is important. Some of the frustration there, though, is if we do a better job, say, on our quitting time count, and therefore, as a result of those efforts, see an increase in homelessness, that works against what HUD is scoring us on in that factor. And that's one of the particular areas where I'd really like to know more information about exactly how they're scoring us. But of course, that information is important. And then in the last section is cross-cutting policies, and in that section, we earned 17 out of 21. Away on our CC performance and strategic planning.
It's the highest score, and then you continue with 187.75.
Questions? Michelle, thank you. Coordinated entry.
That's it. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to be going over the report in your packet. It's the one with the colored graphs on it. It's two pages.
What's that?
Oh, they might be out of sequence.
Oh, they're just out.
If we're out, I do have it up here on the screen so we can follow along. So the purpose of this document really is to start presenting out on how coordinated entry is going so far with regards to folks that are on the community queue, but also those who have been placed in the programs, and how we're, as a system, responding to referrals that are being requested and sending referrals to those programs to ensure that we're meeting the outcome of sort of sending folks as openings are occurring in programs. So that's sort of the basic purpose. The period that I'll be reporting on is January 2017, so that's from January 1 to the 31st of that month. The first graph that you're going to see, Gabby, if you could scroll down to the minute there for folks who don't have it, is the housing intervention recommendation for folks that are active on the community queue. This is including single households and family households. And the VI SPDAT is what we've used to sort of assess our recommendation. My volume? I'm sorry, I'm a little bit sick still, but I'll try to project louder. This is based on how folks scored on the assessment and then what's recommended based on what the COC Advisory Board has approved through the VSPDAT score itself. So whether they fall in PSH, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, or diversion. So if you're looking all the way to the right, you'll see the total for the singles. 200 of those households would have been recommended for diversion, 978 for rapid rehousing or transitional housing, or 1,301 for PSH. Just a little note on the folks that are recommended for PSH. This is based on the score, and so a lot of this is self-reported information, so they may or may not, in fact, meet chronic homeless definition based on HUD's criteria. This is what's self-reported. They have a disabling condition, or they reported their length of homelessness, which may fall into the criteria for chronic homeless. Or some of these folks may just have the score for PSH, but none of the other qualifying elements. So that's just an important clarification. When it comes down to the families, again, looking at the far right bar, you'll see 278 households were recommended for diversion, 577 for rapid rehousing or transitional housing, and then 154 for PSH. Again, based on how they scored on the BSBNAT and what that recommends. I'm going to move on to the next section, which is the referral outcomes for the month of January. So for January, there were 177 referrals that were made through coordinated entry into our participating programs. And this chart sort of follows the outcome. So there were a number of referrals that were requested, and we were shy of the coordinated entry system, about 5 referrals. And that was for the doorway. We continued to try to get that program up and running. So we just left them at full capacity, and we're just continuing to work through to get as many referrals as we can to that program. And then it follows the outcome of enrolled, denied, refused, and then pending outcome. There's a special note on here for the pending because at the end of the month there may not have been a resolution for that referral yet, but that resolution will take place in the following month, just depending on how quickly the provider can either meet with the client and enroll in the report.
Yes, I'm sorry. Clarifying question. So are these numbers all, these aren't, for example, this isn't the number of people enrolled in January, it's the number of people that were referred in January and enrolled, correct?
So yes. Yeah.
They're following the same people.
They follow the same people all the way through. That's a good distinction, yes. Because the next group of charts will show the placements that were made in January, which may or may not have received a referral in that month. The referral may have come from the previous month. This is just those that were placed in the fall. The first chart that you can scroll down to the left is the singles placement. And you'll see that there's, you know, the 3 distinct colors, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, and this is transitional housing. There's just more options available for singles in the month of January, either through new projects coming online or turnover in existing projects. For families, you'll see that there were very few options. In fact, rapid rehousing is the only option for families available in the month of January, which is why you would only see those placements.
And with that, so on the other chart you had where you're showing families, the majority of referrals also, though, were for rapid rehousing instead of permanent sorority housing. And that's more a function of availability than anything else.
Correct. That's what is available through placing folks in the system.
Sort of highlights, it tells us what's happening, but it also highlights where we have deficiencies in our system.
To Kathy's question, isn't that also a function of that's what we got in new projects this year was more rapid rehousing slots?
There
that's
were more
what
rapid rehousing
to
projects.
That's what the capacity is.
True, but we're talking about the family section right now. And then the final graph is chart is showing those that were enrolled in a rapid rehousing program for the month of January have actually received a move-in, which means that they were more than just enrolled, they actually got housed in that month. This is based on the data collected in HMIs. If the agency is putting a move-in date, which is the data quality standard for rapid rehousing, that's where we pull this information. So for singles, there are 31 households enrolled. Of those households, 10 moved in for the month of January, and for families there were 70 enrolled in the program, 18 of them got housed.
So is this a function of just, so they had to be enrolled and housed in the same month? it doesn't show like people who enrolled in December but found housing in January.
Right. This would be the folks that were active in the Rapid Rehousing Fund in January, and then folks that were housed, but they may not be the same people. I know that gets a little bit confusing. It's that in the month of January, what was captured in the system, how many people were enrolled, how that captured them, and how many people were actually housed in that month. So they're not the same people in the system.
Okay. So that what that's showing then is that our rapid rehousing, the folks who enroll in it, are generally not terribly successful at finding housing.
I will leave that interpretation to others, but I mean, if you're looking at the information, fewer people are getting housed than initially enrolled.
Okay.
And are you tracking them in some way throughout the system? So here, you know, the people who are being enrolled aren't necessarily those who are housed, but do you have a way to track the individual throughout the system to know?
Individual and by program. This is just overall. But yeah, if you're asking if they were enrolled, what was the final outcome?
Right.
Yes. You are speaking about that.
And how long it took and all that stuff.
Yeah. And point of enrollment to 20,000.
The referrals requested number, is that just a snapshot at the beginning of the month? Or
that's how many referrals were requested in the entire month.
In the entire month.
So at the end of that month, on the 31st, how many have gotten requested?
Throughout the day. Is that higher or low, 177? Is that average?
That's actually fairly low, considering some of our permanent supportive housing programs weren't able to take folks, so usually we have to do more PSH.
What, because they were full? Or?
No, because they are still coming online, and
oh, okay.
Some folks are having a difficult time leasing up houses to move.
Okay, good.
So how does it compare to January 2015?
It's a good question. I'd have to look at comparing previous months or a previous year to now. And a lot of the data we're capturing now may not have been captured then. So the ability to look at this.
Okay. I'll just add, this is the first month that we've been producing this report, and we do it every month, the coordinated activity committee, and don't forget this as a
and we're also working to the day where this is in the model. By the best example I've seen so far, Andrew brought my attention, is King County. So if you go to King County's website, it's in there, they have the most dynamic data. It's real time. We've looked at LA, San Diego, and we're working with ABT Consulting right now to assist us. Tableau is the company that has done the data outcomes and the dashboard, but one in King County also uses the same operating system that we work with, Claire. So Andrew's contacting King County, and we have an appointment to talk to the CEO of Claire to see how we can move forward.
So on the, you had a record of the like denials, and are we also sort of tracking that to be able to better understand when people have been denied, what the factors?
Yeah, this is sort of the most overview, but keeping track of specific reasons for denial and outcomes of that, we keep track of that as well, just not as much as we're.
Oh, I apologize. It's a little bit confused. Go back to the very first graph. You got your little recommended for housing intervention. And so, you know, on our veterans by name list, we've got 321 names listed on there. And in theory, they should all have had the VSDF and entered into the system. So the number doesn't match. Is that because we're missing people out there, or is this a
Manjeet might be able to answer that question more specifically. This is the information that I get based on the community queue, but I don't know, to be honest, when you can speak to
the that finding list combines people who are in the shelters or transitional housing that haven't had a year. So when you're talking about the community queue, we're only talking about those who have had people.
One last thing before I let folks off the hook with questions. The table on this, if it seems confusing, it's the same exact information represented in the graphs, but if you're having a difficult time looking at the numbers themselves, you can reference back to these tables for the specific numbers. I just left it in here. One, I presented to the Coordinating Entry Committee, so I want to make sure you guys add it too. But two is to just reference.
Any more questions for Andrew or comments? Thank you very much. I'd like to quote what Ryan just said. He thanks God every day that Andrew works with him. I think we should add our thanks to that. Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, no problem.
System performance measures.
Making sure that Gabrielle has a presentation. She is really on the ball. Thank you.
Okay, so everyone should have a copy of this in their packet as well. This is our benchmark year of HUD's system performance measures. So this data was reported with our team of care application of 2016. And we're bringing it here so that you can all be familiar with it as well. Manjeet and I prepared this presentation together to really help to submit the data. So there's detailed information I made for her, but I'll cover the presentation with you. The presentation will start off with the system performance measures, background and purpose, also how HUD uses this information, the data sources and reporting timeframes, then we'll dive into the seven system performance measures themselves, including what the measures are, what they're intended to, what the desired outcomes are, and then our performance. So the background and purpose, as I said, fiscal year 2016 NOFA, 2016 NOFA is the first year that we'll be reporting on these and we'll continue to report on them annually. So 2016 is the benchmark. It will also help us gauge our progress and identify areas for improvement. And then HUD will use this information, next slide, to evaluate how COCs are improving their performance from year to year, and in the future could be used as part of the selection criteria to award projects in the future. So this is important data that we need to keep track of and we need to focus on. Reporting period is October 1st to September 30th of each year, and we use two data sources here. It's primarily the client level data from HYS, but also our point in time count data for the one of the measures. And except where noted, once we dive into particular measures, they're for everything the HYS, not just CUC-funded projects, where that's an exception, it's noted. The next slide covers the actual measures themselves. So the seven things that HUD's looking to evaluate our system on are length of time homeless, returns to homelessness, the number of homeless persons, employment and income growth, persons who become homeless for the first time, homelessness prevention and housing placement of persons defined by category 3 of HUD's homeless definition. This is not currently applicable in our state, and we're not a high-performing community yet, and haven't been able to use HUD funding for prevention programs, so we hope to be measured on item 6 in the future, but not.
Can I ask a question on that? If we had prevention programs outside of the COC that we were capturing data on, would we then be able to kind of present that kind of, I'm not saying it's category 3, but could we start proving that we were becoming a high performing?
I think because the report is in the system.
The way we
So the way it's programmed to include this system, so you can take a look at this and see if they're looking at one. For intervention, currently we only have ESG has two prevention, there's the family director, and then there's the SSEF has the prevention. So overall, we really don't have much of a prevention, but we can definitely take a look into just the effects.
So if we got a prevention program, we might be able to capture it.
If we had the HUD funded project,
well, but if it was a non-HUD funded project, if it was a non-HUD from the project, could we maybe still capture the data and show that we're doing something about it?
It could still be captured as far as in HMIS, but as far as looking at the, if those are returning back to the system in a way, the program specs are not written in a way from HUD to look at. We see that that's been coming on. HUD will probably, and this was the first time around, so I think we might need one.
I would just think if they're not to fund prevention, then we should be able to capture non-HUD funded prevention until we get, until we are. It's like the people for me.
And there's other, and we can tell our story in a number of ways, but under this, that's just going to
be so. This is, this is one of the topics we know the DC chapter.
And then the seventh measure is successful housing placements and retention. Jumping into the specific measures, as I said, measure one is the length of time homeless. That's what we're measuring, and it looks at an average and median days spent in emergency shelter and transitional housing home, with the desired outcome of reducing those. So this is not capturing unsheltered clients or, that pathway. So emergency shelter, transitional housing only. And you can see in the chart for 2015 is blue and 2016 is red. So the average length of time in emergency shelter was 64 days in 2015 and 76 in 2016. And then the median for that project type is 35 days and 44 days. And then if you combine the emergency shelter and transitional housing stays together, the average length of time in both projects is 130 in 2015 and 126 in 2016. And if you look at the median, that's 61 days and 68 days.
When does this start coming? So does it start the first time they show up at an emergency shelter, or does this start, you know, is this saying they've been homeless for so many days before they enter the shelter?
It's just the time spent in the shelter or in transitional housing programs. It could be more than one shelter. It could be different points of the year.
So it's the first time they go into a shelter, it starts counting from that point forward.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go in and out of a shelter or multiple shelters and back on the street, and it keeps ticking. Mm-hmm.
So it's not a project level measure for person. It's a cumulative amount of time a person is in a shelter versus the length of the average length of stay in a shelter.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not
for a particular project.
But just to add, this upcoming year that we'll be reporting, it's also going to take in consideration the day their episode starts. Whatever they're reporting to us, they became homeless on this thing. So the next report that we'll be submitting, it will take that into consideration. But this measure one only looks at the entry into the shelter and the transitional, but the second part to this will be the one that's looking at the episode when it started. Since we didn't have much data or had added that question when we baked into the system, so they didn't require last year that measure to be submitted. So we'll be submitting that this year. That will take a look at when the person actually is
there. So we'll capture more accurately the duration of homelessness, not just the time spent in the shelter. So measure two
This is Returns to Homelessness, and the measure is being sent to which persons who exit homelessness to a permanent destination return to homelessness within 6 months to 2 years. And it looks back, the 2 year look back from the reporting time frame. So, during the time frame being measured, persons who returned to homelessness, persons who had exited to permanent housing within the previous 2 years or returned in the year being measured, that's what we correct?
Yes. So the reporting period, last reporting period was 2014 to 2015. So it looks 2 years back. So the look back date was October 1st, 2012. So that whole year, anyone that's returned to permanent housing, then returned within that 2014 to 15 time frame is what that measure is.
And if we take a look at the data, the exits from permanent housing exit, it's kind of like, I don't want to confuse people. Folks who exited emergency shelter to permanent housing and then returned to homelessness was 1,168 in the 2012-13 time frame and 1,058 in the 13-14 time frame.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's the number? Is there a number of people?
Yes.
Not families.
Michelle, these are all returns from homelessness.
Yes.
These are not returns. Those are exits. This is how many people exited.
So we found out why we have so many homeless people.
So what you're looking at the chart is how many exited during that time frame that we just discussed, which, you know, for it's written at the bottom. So from October 2012 to October 2013, and then from October 13 to 14, those chart bars are lining up with that, how many of those people actually exited. And then when you look at the follow-up chart, then it will go into saying how many people actually, of those, returned back.
Yeah, sorry about that. Got it. I have got two slides for that. Get us to
These are successful exits, actually. So when we're talking about successful exit, we're talking about high definition of successful exit. That's what we were told. Housing could be going back to the family rent. They're renting their own apartment, they're going with a subsidy, any of those that could be coming.
So number two is successful exit.
Measure two is how many of those that were exited to permanent housing were returned within that 2 years.
This one is
a slide you took to give you an idea of how many actually exited, so you can look at what percent of those that come.
Jan, the exits from permanent housing, is that only permanent housing or is that free property?
So we report to HUD on multiple time frames. So folks were returning in less than 6 months, 6 to 12 months. 13.4 months, and then the total is the 2 years. And we've represented in this chart where the exit was from, so emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent housing. If you look at the blue bars, those are total returns.
So in that first, that shorter, less than 6 month time frame, we're looking at total returns of not quite 15%. And as we move all the way over to the 2 year time frame, it comes up to between 20% and 25%.
So,
so
is the 25% then return, that's based off of, so for 16, the 2,330, correct? So if the number of exits for 2016 that fell in that two-year window, the total return would be 25% of that?
Correct.
Okay.
And there's no way to separate on here the difference between current square housing and rental housing?
This is actually not taking a look at, it's only looking at the people who have entered the shelters, not just returns, and outreach programs. Well, actually, it is looking at the housing, so sorry. We can.
Well, I'm just curious to see if there is a difference between
the
difference.
Well, the chart and the chart that you're looking at, it says exit was from permanent housing, from PH. Those are the ones that, well, it's anything.
That's
so,
right. Breaking
down.
I think for a HUD's
purpose,
it's better.
Yeah. We can do our own. Yeah.
Now, another thing that might be helpful, because we have different stock numbers of units in each type of stock, it may be misleading when you look at so many exits. We have very few transitionals and a lot of permanent housing. So the percentage of return within each category would be helpful to know which is working best.
Well, and during this time frame, we had a ton of transitional housing because this is from 2009.
So then that, without, see, now I made an assumption that was incorrect. So it would be good to have that data broken down over time. Patty?
Yeah, I guess I think all of these reports, all of these graphs, all of these statistics start to become a bowl of spaghetti in my head as, you know, we look at presentations. But what is interesting here is that I thought in other reporting or in presentations that we had showed that permanent housing had the least lowest percentage of return to homelessness, and this is showing that permanent housing has the highest percentage return to homelessness. And
that's what I'm trying to say. This doesn't capture that. And permanent housing in this also includes just straight market housing or going to live with your sister. It's not. This isn't just permanent supportive housing, which does have a very low rate of return.
Did you say that?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what he said.
Since are these numbers, the returns larger because the total number of homeless people has to be larger?
That's what the number is. PH slugs, residents, is a bigger proportion of the population of people
Anyhow, I think we need to be able to answer that question if this gets out, because I know that we've gone before the Board of Supervisors and City Council with statistics that say permanent housing is the highest percentage of success and lowest percentage return to homelessness. And then, you know, the problem is people see so much data and they look at this and they make their own conclusion.
Amani, and then
so.
We
eventually to transition.
So from the shelter, when we're looking at the exits for permanent, we are looking at those who are moving into the ESH process. So there could be exit to the ESH, exit to rental housing, and exit to family. Right? So when we're looking at the return, we're looking at those who have exited to any of those, how many of those have been back to our system into a shelter and transitional housing. This is only looking at those who exited from those destinations to permanent, not all of the all exits.
I think it's an artifact that's being a small relative to the
Karen, I'm trying to understand. Overall, exit from shelters could be a lot, it could be in thousands, but we only looking at the portion that reported in HMIs just saying they exited to permanent housing. So if we're looking at the very small percentage of people,
because
the first is all exit from shelters that could be going to the transitional, could be ended up in jail, could end up in an institution, any of those. We're not looking at that data, at least not for this measure, as far as the HUD is written. So this is this is set up exactly how the HUD wanted it. The specs came directly to our vendors to have it, programmed in the way. So right now, we just have to take a look at it, which of our systems, which of our project type is doing what, where is the people exiting from to permanent housing and how are they coming back to our system, and what percent are coming back? Because our PSH, showing great, we have less than 5% coming back to the system, those who do exit that. So overall, in our continuum, those exited 2 years ago, or in those settings, altogether 25% or so are coming back to the system rather than back to the year, who reported to going into permanent.
Aaron,
and
then Mike.
I think I just might be delivering the same point, but we have invested really heavily in wraparound housing in this community, so we need to know the difference between the returns to homelessness and wraparound housing and permanent support housing, and also the cost per participant for both of those measures, so that we can actually decide how, as a community, we're going to invest in the future. So that, I think it's alarming to see 25% return to homelessness, and most of us know that that PSH number is under 5, so we need to see that broken out. I think that's what we're asking.
We can definitely do our own analysis and as far as the purposes of breaking down the PSH in that way, with proper revenue. But this is directly from HUD, so that can't be changed. We can do our own analysis.
We'll finish it up your review.
I have a question about changes to parts of the system and how that will affect these data going forward. So I understand that the county staff is all wrapped up in the issues of how CalWORKs is going to change. And it's going to change by program rules that heretofore have essentially limited that once per lifetime, and now it's going to be a recurring enrollment opportunity, which sounds to me like there's going to be possible negative impacts on the data. There's going to be in some fraction of CalWORKs and LOU who continue to participate in the program for a number of months, drop out, come back, drop out. I mean, couldn't do that before, but we will be able to do that, and that's going to make at least that fraction of the statistics much more. Correct in my understanding of that?
That those types of changes in the system.
And
since this is a strictly HMIS data, anytime you bring a new project on board to start entering in HMIS, that could change our numbers like for the future, right? So we may be looking at 2015 data now, and then 2 years later, we're looking at 2016 data, we're going to say, oh, well, why there's way more exits, way more people coming back to the homelessness, right? It can also be that we brought in two new big shelters that never entered before, right? And we're looking at that data differently, and we may have some data quality issues for those people that we just brought in. So a lot of factors can play in some of the data that we need. Participation in HMIS is one day one, and so that is looking just to add to this, how to improve these as some of these data standards that we're or measures that we're talking about, HUD is also asking to better the coverage is, the better the data you're going to have, right? So we are really working hard now to bring in all these projects out there that serve homeless not participating in HMIS yet, right? So we are doing our best to bring those entities on board so we can start looking at the actual big picture of what's really happening.
So it is, it may just be belaboring what everybody has said, but it does, it is alarming to see data put out which could be brought widely out to the public that tells such a skewed piece of the story for us. And it just seems like any time we have data like this, we have to, and if it's a document that's going to be out, that you have to really footnote it and explain the basis of why this looks the way it does, because the story it tells doesn't help us in advancing our public policy to address homelessness and the systems that we're using. So it just seems to me we should never have a document released like this that doesn't qualify the basis for which, you know, you're using a limited pool and that's how this is coming. And anytime you look at something and it just sort of smacks as that doesn't make sense, there should be an explanation. Or your own data, which then the more fuller picture, even if HUD doesn't, that's not how they're looking at it, then say this is how HUD is looking at it, and then, but this is what we have in our system and this tells the complete picture. Because it is so critical now that we have good data, that we have systems that really allow us to effectively tackle the biggest problems, and this kind of system doesn't let us do that. And it could hurt the overall system in the public officials' perspectives and the public's perspective.
So I'm listening to this and thinking, you know, what is it that we can take from this, like, general 5,000 feet? What I get is that 100% of the time, which frankly is better than I expected. So it's not so simple. But, and then a couple of slides back to the median, it looks like things have gone up in terms of length of stay and shelter, which I think says a lot about the housing stock available. Mm-hmm. So I mean, to me, I'm surprised that we have such a low return on this, given how bad it is going to be.
But making those. But a lot of people, and you're exactly right, I mean, in some ways, if you're looking at this, does part of this, and that's what we were sort of saying when we looked at the length of time, it is a big reflection in the stock that we have. So should be great evidence for us to be working on increasing the stock. And some of that is we should be using every opportunity we have to make those cases. That data on themselves, without saying what it tells us and how it can be used to advance our cause, isn't helpful. And I don't mean that. I don't mean that.
A couple of slides back, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it says the median, which is the most stable market, is very compelling. But we need to, we're keeping people in shelter, in transitional places, in order to maximize the likelihood that we have in.
And in addition, if the data tells us that we might be slightly off in our strategy, that we need to be adjusting our strategy to reflect the data. So I think all those things, all those points are true. So if we drill down to more of an analysis, before we, I agree, releasing it, you know, like ends up in the paper and it looks like a really bad job. When in fact, what Jonathan pointed out is that things are actually looking better relative to the situation we find ourselves in, but we have to be able to explain that really clearly.
That's why we take some of the meeting, which has been mistaken. That maybe the most of us can help you today to come to the
meeting. Well, and it's hard to compare like this to this, because this is 12:13 and this is 15:6. Yeah, right, so let's just be careful, but let's understand that there is information here, not just not going to be able to do that. I'm just giving you the wrong here.
Yeah, but the thing is, the reason we are looking at 2013 and 2014 data is because that's what, because we have to measure something, right? That we are measuring 2-year periods, and of those that exited that time, those have came back. So we have to look at that old data to see that piece, right?
But I mean, we're not comparing them, we're just going to be through the house. So it's like we can't look at the system in the old house, because we don't know that.
So right now, it's like
again, the point you had made earlier about that the pH in this is permanent housing, not permanent supportive housing, and it could be a wide range of things. But when people see it, I mean, I looked at it, the first thing I thought was, oh my God, permanent supportive housing is doing the worst of these things. So also making sure if people aren't used to seeing pH, you know, your first thing you're going to go is to permanent supportive housing.
We actually have a table that shows all the different outcomes.
I think that would be helpful.
Michelle, yes. On a whole thing down, what would the central government have to do with the system? What would the current quarter of going back and 2 quarters back, if we project the progress that we made, what Kathy's point for application, we set the footprints and footnotes on this, and you would ask what would those be, discuss that, so we all know how that is. What would a good quarter be with going back from a second quarter, projecting that 2 years out? How much better is that than what we're saying? It seems to build that from the city system that's now active.
You're asking what time frame would you represent?
What are we currently doing that's better than that, since we don't know that? What is our current efficiency? Because Kathy's question has to be answered before we really need the quantification of the improvement.
Well, it doesn't matter which time frame you write for the measure two, it's not going to help us at this point. But measure one, looking at the how our system right now may have made a difference in the route that we have here and everything else, we can look at the last So we can look at the October 1st to December 30th, see how we did in that quarter, you know, versus these 2 years that we have.
You have a real number, real data.
We could, but I don't have it right now with me.
Well, then, do you have a guesstimate on that? I think
well, I think perhaps it'll be helpful if we can do the additional charts and then look at it as
We do need to move on. You can also have to approve your renewal project
scoring
tools as well. Okay, so measure two is the number of persons who are homeless, and this includes our account data as well as HMIS. So look at this chart. There's two charts here. The first is point in time, and the second is HMIS. 2015 was a sheltered and unsheltered count year. 2016 was an unsheltered count. So that's why you'll see zero unsheltered in that last section of 3.1. But our unduplicated total homeless persons, 2,659 in 2015, with the sheltered and unsheltered, and then 1,552 in 2016, which is the emergency shelter.
And then putting those two bars beside each other, I think it looks like we really reduced homelessness, and we really don't know that.
Right.
Yeah, we don't know what the census is going to be.
And then we have a 2.2, the unduplicated shelter count. Have that for this the HMIS sheltered in 2015 was 4,737 and then 4,230 in 2016. And then emergency shelter 3,498 and 3,449 in 2016. And then for transitional housing
non-employment, cash income, and then children. Yeah, and it's for HUD COC. The right to the chart, which is also there. So again, it presents 2015 data and 2016 data, so there's the blue and the red. And then metric 4.1 is the change in employment income for folks who remain in the system. And 4.2 is change in non-employment income for folks who remain in the system. 4.3 is total cash income for folks who remain in the system. And then the last three pertain to system leavers. So 4.4, change in employment income for system leavers. 4.5, change in non-employment income for system leavers. And then 4.6, change in total cash income. So this is a ton of information, and this change in income is something that has measured at the project level as well. And we can say lots of things about it. It's quite a bit of what you want to say about this thing. Project requires the increased income.
So the difference, looking at metric 4.2 and 4.3, comparing 2015 to 2016, the bars are very different. Why is that? Why is there such a difference? The other bars are closer to each other, but then something happens.
10%
up to 31%
of this is the level 4,
the manager. We're going to find out because if we're doing something way better in 2016,
like,
let's do it more.
Yeah.
Or were things not being counted in 2019?
Like, I don't know. Like, there was staff education.
So, yeah, I don't even know what the metric is. So this is one of the metrics that, since it's only for the high-sensitive projects, right? So all the high-sensitive projects are required to do an annual assessment in the database and have our plan. So that what we have found is that some places it was lacking. So we are improving in some areas. People have gone back to some of the data to update those assessments. But this is one of the metrics that we may have to revise the HUD this year, even for our baseline. Is that data may have improved in our way for 2015 to now, because we have put there more emphasis on training-wise, making sure people are doing that assessment that's required, so we can see the changes, what income they came in with, and what they have now, even if they're staying in the program still, right? So we are hoping to have this, but I think overall, as far as the deeper are concerned, most of our folks are leaving with better income from these high-funded projects than what they came in with, right? So that does show that there's we're meeting that those benchmark goals, right?
And this income, does it include
it's broken on, broken down with the metric one is increasing earnings, which helps employment income. And then the metric two is non-employment income, which does include in
government.
Yes. Okay. And then there's a total income and use that combined, so, you know, whatever you call it. This is kind of way to read this. It's kind of, trust me. After we put some books up, you know, hold the staff to make sense out of these. So. I think we just need to be, as a COC, how are we doing in the project? Instead of looking at one project at a time, because this is going in all high-funded projects, this is what's happening. If it's not meeting our benchmarks, it's not meeting our baseline, whatever that would be, then we need to be figuring out what's not happening in those projects.
John, and then Kathy.
Mr. Secretary, I recognize the importance of this report.
but I hope we can stop right now talking about it and go on to review and rank report, which we actually have to do about today. It's a critical question, and we're not going to have any time to really look at it. I just have done a mistake, so let this take my time. Stop.
And I, in deference to that, I'm willing to move on.
Okay, so we will bring this remaining part of the report to this body at our next meeting, and we will go to the action item, approval of performance review committee, mid-year rank and tool review. Kimberly?
Good morning, everyone. The Performance Review Committee has finalized a mid-year renewal tool for us to be able to do a mid-year assessment of all the projects, see where they're at. That way you can update any bad data or make any necessary changes before the NOFA competition, as well as looking at projects that the advisory board may make a recommendation that we don't approve. So Homebase is here, and we have a new team. Tara actually is part of our old team that's going to be transitioning out, and then Jason is a member of our new team that has just started, and they're going to walk us through the tool that the Performance Review Committee approved.
Thank you, Kimberly. So the tool's divided into three main sections. The first is threshold factors. Those are pass-fail. So if a project can't manage the basic tasks and the threshold factors, they don't clear the threshold, and they wouldn't be part of the competition. Part of the point of having a mid-year review is if somebody fails a threshold factor, now we can work with them and say, all right, how do we get you over this threshold in time for the competition?
So can I ask a question at that point, Michelle? So is this, do people know whether they've passed this or not at this point?
They submitted and everyone submitted it and it was reviewed. I don't know about the communication back out.
So we're still in the process of reviewing some of that, and a couple people we've reached out to for amended documents, but in the next probably 2 weeks we'll be sending out letters if you've met the threshold requirements.
And we feel like we've got adequate staff support to help agencies to comply with changes in HUD requirements and other policies, procedures, all that, right?
Yes.
The threshold requirement about coordinated entry?
Projects are required to participate in coordinated entry unless they haven't been added to the system yet, because we're working to accommodate them. So the shelter plus care projects and the TLCS projects are not yet participating, and that's not a because they haven't built the system to accommodate that
again. And all of you received a memo to the Performance Review Committee that shared that information that met this threshold requirement, so that shouldn't be received by anyone that's not currently participating. If for some reason you didn't receive that in your email, let me know and I can send you. And I went out in the mail as well.
The second section is our experimental measures on page 2. So these will be evaluated by the Rank Review Committee, but the points they assign won't be added to the project's total score. We find that if we just say this is a non-scored factor but it's important, everyone thinks we're winking and nodding at them. Nobody believes us when we say it's important. So this is a way of doing a practice run. We score them, we come up with, okay, this is 2 points, your project had 3 points on this. If we add this to the scored section next season, this is how you would do, but for this one competition, we won't throw the points toward your final score. So there's 2 experimental measures here. One is cost per household. We're trying to figure out whether your program is reasonably cost effective for what it's doing and who it's serving. And 2 is the extent of your participation in the coordinated entry system. So if you don't participate at all, if you say, oh, the heck with the coordinated entry system, that's a threshold factor. But if you say you're participating in coordinated entry, but and then it turns out that many of your beds are being filled outside of the coordinated entry system, many of the people sent to you by the coordinated entry system are not actually welcomed into your program, then that would affect the scoring on the second measure.
So Michelle, these are reports that are generated by Steps Forward staff, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So are they, have they been shared with the different programs so they know where they stand on these two things?
That's actually the purpose. That will happen within this mid-year review.
Okay.
So then what does happen to those of us who are not coordinated by, not our choice? Like, we're attending, we're trying, we're participating, but we're not coordinated. What happens to the points for them?
The shortcut answer, right, is that it gives you leverage to go and talk to the coordinated entry people and say, this is what would happen to my project if we can't fix this.
So, but we're doing that, we're in that process, it's circumstances beyond our control for that piece. It's a bigger question than just do we want to or not. It's a large system level question. So I see that they're not counted now, but if they're counted at the end of the year, that's going to be a huge problem. So how are we going to manage it?
Well, it would be counted in 2018.
Right, it'd be next year. Next year.
Yeah.
So we got a year to get some more funds.
Okay.
Okay. What the minutes?
Yeah.
Then the other question is about cost. I mean, programs serve very different populations using very different techniques. On the face of it, it doesn't seem possible to compare, say, what I do with what some of the programs do, because the way I do it is obviously cheaper, and it's not fair to them to, you know what I mean? So how do you make this a reasonable way to do it?
So I think it's important to remember that these are the experimental factors, and we want to collect the information, see what we learn from there, and then a performance review committee will obviously have enough discussion about what's reasonable to measure moving forward.
And that was brought, that was at length conversation during the design of and that point was brought up by providers.
This is also a measure that there are several ways to do it out there in the community, that other communities are doing it, we're working with Home Base on, and it's a factor that HUD requires that they see on the scoring tool.
So John, are you concerned that it's not sensitive enough to how cheap you are? I know that sounds wrong, but
he wants bonus points for being
cheap. You want to have a sensitive enough metric so that you can look at cost efficiency and outcome, right?
Well, yeah, I think that there are other ways to do it besides what I do that might be a good way to do it. They might be more costly, but maybe it's got some benefits. And I guess the gross just dollars and cents thing doesn't work.
Yeah, and we talked about taking into consideration the population, families versus singles, length of time. And those are all parts of the discussion.
It does seem like that's absolutely critical, because you also then have a system where you're driving people to serve the easiest to serve instead of the hardest to serve, because they're more expensive, and you at least have to have a system which will acknowledge the impact of that before you make these broad generalizations of cost.
Well, I think that's why it's important that you, one, have to be part of credit interest, so say the standard for who you were being sent, and then we're measuring the outcome of those that you're serving. So we are holding the coordinated entry system accountable for those that are being referred, and then the outcome of the program, and then measuring both the cost of the program. So there's still a lot of nuance.
So who's going to have that conversation? I mean, that'd be the rank and review committee, and then report back here so we could talk about it.
And when it comes back around next year, we'll have to work out those metrics. Susie?
Are new projects going to get a report as well, even though we won't be scored for the...
Yes.
Okay, good. So we'll have a year and a half to get our...
Eric?
So how does it work if you're so as a cost per participant, is it just the HUD dollars that are counted as a cost per participant?
No, it's total cost.
So even if we're getting our funding from some completely other source for the service side, that goes into the cost per participant?
That was the conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It is for house.
This number, up at the top here, the cost for households served, I like the idea of categorizing it so that you're
comparing the like populations. So we have projects serving families, projects serving unaccompanied youth, and then everybody else. That everybody else seems too broad to me, because right now, chronic, non-chronic, you have veterans of different needs, and non-veterans, the chronic, homeless veterans of different needs, and non-chronic, homeless, single, blah, blah, blah. So, how do we come to this, everybody else in the third level?
It's a tricky compromise. There's only so many programs in the COC, and so if you divide them into too many categories, the concept of above average costs starts to lose some of its meaning. All right, if you have four programs, okay, this program is above average. So one way around that is to pull programs from outside Sacramento County and try and compare to their costs. That wasn't a popular suggestion with the committee. Another is to lose the idea of averages and just say the highest ranking, the highest cost program would lose points. That can feel judgmental. There are ways around it, but that was some of the logic behind having only a few categories.
So I'm gonna continue to argue this point a little bit more, because that doesn't seem like an even playing for program. So I absolutely agree and support the idea of comparing all like programs with each other. I think that's really important. But I think it's practically impossible to do it from a year of costs to programs serving very divergent populations. I don't think that gives us an accurate idea of, I think we're trying to get efficiency and effectiveness, and I don't think we can get to that by comparing families who aren't sheltered, who are chronically homeless. I don't think you get to that.
So well, we're not comparing shelters, we're comparing funded programs.
It's a serious concern. What I would ask is that you wait until we hit page 4 and see if that alleviates any of your concerns. So the rest of the pages fall into the third section, which is the ordinary scored factors, measures that count toward the points that would be assigned to the project to help the rank review committee assign it a place in the priority order. Sure, sorry about that. So the rest of the pages are for the regular scored factors that make up the score that the rank review committee uses to assign each program a place in the ranked list that gets submitted to HUD. One of the new factors in agency capacity is regular quarterly drawdowns. That used to be a pass-fail factor, but in the interest of transparency, we're now saying you have to make one drawdown a year to avoid being failed out.
A quarter.
So the threshold factor is once per year, and then the scored factor is regular quarterly drawdowns every single quarter. So if you've made 3 drawdowns this year and you've drawn down all of your funding, you would lose points, but you wouldn't automatically be disqualified.
I'm sorry, say that again.
If you've made 3 drawdowns over the past year instead of the 4 that you're supposed to, you would lose points in the competition, but you would not be automatically disqualified. Whereas if you have not made a single drawdown of funds all year, that would be disqualified. So that's one small change.
I'm sorry, if
you're doing
monthly, then it's okay.
Monthly is fine, yes.
So I just wanted to go on record with the data quality one. The permanent supported housing program 3-day turnaround is pretty difficult, and especially and so that's what's inside, embedded in the data quality plan. We brought it up before as a point of discussion. Love to talk about it again. We also don't even really know for sure, and have asked this question and not gotten an answer as to does the 3-day clock start at lease up, or when? So that, and if you're on, and could we have it be a 3-day working day instead of a 3-day calendar day? That's a real difficult thing to accomplish in PSH programs. So,
where are you?
And the data quality agency has complied with COC data quality plan. So it's only just talking about compliance, but within the document of compliance is the 3-day turnaround. And I know it's in the weeds, but somewhere you have to talk about it. So,
so, so, 72 hours that the data has to be entered from the time that the person enters or leaves the program. Could we be comfortable to make that business hours?
So Manjeet, this is a HUD measure, correct?
In a sense it is, but at the same time we can set the threshold ourselves what that means. But in our data quality plan, when we were meeting, we just couldn't figure, doing it weekdays versus weekend, not including it, just wasn't feasible. We just said, okay, let's start off with the 3 days and then see what happens. So I think at this point we just have to figure out the threshold, if it needs to be 3 days or 3 to 5 days. There's a breakdown in our report that says 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, and then 3 to 5 days, I think it says. So maybe for the review and grant, that threshold needs to be reviewed. Just look, anything.
I think Manjeet's saying that we may be able to, we can alter how we measure compliance with timeliness. So and the data quality plan is updated or revised annually, and we have more information. We can revisit that at the HMIS data committee and make sure that we share that with.
I'd just like to ask that this discussion come to the performance review committee, because I think there's a lot of implications. I mean, I remember from Renew and Rank, a lot of projects, surprisingly to us last year, didn't meet this standard, and we didn't understand the details behind it. But I think there's also, it sounds like, I get where the programs are kind of, there's also implications that you get to full implementation of coordinated entry, and I would hate to beget one for the other. And so I just, like, whatever the HMIS data committee recommends, I'd like to have a full explanation at the performance review committee, because I think there's implications of other system components that are just equally as important.
So,
we're all trying to comply, right? Right, and or whoever decides to get it, and we get the 2 points to say, well, you didn't comply in this one area,
right.
So no points.
Right.
So I think that's kind of what you need to do.
Michelle, some of these are things that you're going to be, just from looking at records that you keep, right? We're going to report so much as you're going to look at them. So you would, once this is adopted, this would be some of these would be things, like you would be sending out the information that we're out of compliance, for example.
This process, you'll get feedback on the performance on the tool from the Performance Review Committee, and then there'll actually be a list of TA, like a TA plan for each project. And then the rest of the year, right, any compliance issues related to monitoring will come from our contracts department. So, but within compliance with what's being scored here, that'll be communicated through this mid-year review, performance review committee process.
So a program that felt like maybe they didn't agree with the out-of-compliance aspect, or they had some issues with it, or if it turned out that none of us complied, we could recognize that and have that conversation. Could you be sending this out quite soon?
Right? You'll get the information in time to do something about it and have a conversation about it, and the committee will certainly look at the impact.
But we could potentially bring that forward to the HMIS committee to say, geez, if no one's complying, maybe our goal isn't working.
I thought this was lined up with HUD. So this is lined up with our funding priorities as well, right? Isn't this all like internal compliance? So if we could agree as a continuum to say no, we're not going to do that, but then that threatens our score.
Right. We can't say we're not going to do it, but we could talk about how we're measuring.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So like if we set a timeliness standard that everyone has to do their entries and exits in 3 days, and if your average is 3.5 days, then you don't get the points. That's one way to measure it. Or maybe we measure it under a different standard, like only you have to have less than 5% of your entries and exits entered outside the target you set, or something like that. So that's the kind of flexibility or conversation we can have. Not
3 days is not a HUD rule.
What's that?
I just wanted to clarify so that there's at some point, whatever score this is, we're going to get this reporter, like, hey, this is your score. Let's fix it. Yep. Right. So that we're not blockaded. Okay.
Yes.
So that we have time and we're not blindsided. Right.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yes.
Okay,
that's good.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's
good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like there's quite a bit of nuance that's missing from this document. Is there an accompanying document, for example, that says how you will score these factors? If it's the 3-day relocation, the things that we're talking about now, I think a lot of the questions exist because that information is not available.
So,
for example, scoring threshold for citation and coordinated entry, this particular compliance component, would that be available at some point? And so,
can you guys talk about how you put together the report for Presto and all those pieces for the review process? I think that
should. Sure. So, the Ranking Review Committee has in front of them a detailed illustrated report on each project. We take the APR data from each project, and we take the answers that the project provides to a supplemental questionnaire. It helps fill out some of the parts that the annual performance report would miss. And that all gets integrated so that the Ranking Review Committee can see how is this project doing relative to its peers, what absolute numbers has it put up in terms of performance? What are the percentages for that? What does it have to say for itself to put that performance in context? And then we usually also bring in a representative from the project to answer questions, either live or by phone, so that if the Ranking Review Committee isn't sure what it all means, they can talk to the project about it. So the idea is to have the fullest picture possible that's consistent with a reasonably efficient ranking review. And as far as digging down into what is the data quality plan, or you know, what does a coordinated entry compliance report look like, that would all be in front of the Ranking Review Committee.
Would it be provided to the program participants so that we can ensure that we're meeting the standards set by us? This is kind of like a goalpost that's really wide. And
what are the outcomes of the mid-year review is for you to get that level of feedback on your performance?
So all of this data is available in HMIS for you to pull those reports at any time. And it may just be that you don't know which report to pull. So we can definitely...
I think the question is more specifically to how we're going to measure compliance with those reports and what numbers, and how we're going to interpret those numbers to base the score and all that. So
will we be providing the data, like the data quality performance providers to check and then send back to us? Regular review rank process work.
I don't think that we'll have time to do that because we'll be ending the calendar or the time measured March 31st, and then rank and review will meet 2 weeks later. So it'll be measured based on the data that you're entering, but you can run your APR at any time and look at that information.
So for the data compliance question in particular, we'll make sure to share with providers how we're measuring that, because that is not embedded in the tool itself. You can't see what the standard is. And then you'll be able to see your performance on it when you get your feedback on the mid-year review. And I looked through, I don't think any of the other capacity questions.
So I think something we can do is tie each of these to which report corresponds in HMIS so that you can then run the report and look at where you're at, and that's something we talked about quite a bit.
So in addition to, that would be super helpful, first of all. Second of all, I've asked a couple of times for either training or some kind of reports training for EBs or whoever EBs design needs it, because, you know, being somebody who's fairly new to COC funded projects, we never received any kind of training about how to even read an APR, and let me tell you, they're not like user friendly. So I don't even know what I'm looking at, whether it's good or bad.
We actually have a APR training on March 31st. We can send that out.
Asking each other
to make sure all the providers get the right.
Also, I just wanted to just reference back to the HMIS data quality plan that
that has the baseline and that has what percent should fall in their way in order to be compliant with the actual standard. I mean, I'm sorry, the plans. So when you're looking at that, make sure you also read in the plan that you have gone. If you don't have it for some reason, it's on our website too.
We covered the plan during the last executive director training. As well as placed it in the portal. So everyone has access to it, and any executive director that showed up to that mandatory training, we covered it.
And all your HRIS persons should know which report is one, but they can always
contact us. Also, I wanted to know that in addition to the APR, so for, I believe for the mid-year process as well as for the 2017 NOFA, are we looking at responses from, or narrative responses from your local application or your request for information, and so those questions correspond to your PESTO reports as well. So they inform the different scoring measures, and they also have sort of a more detailed question, so we'll be asking specific things like how you're compliant with the data policy and other things. So that can also give a little bit more information about what we're looking for.
Can you provide a little more clarification on the second one where it says agency has no unresolved monitoring findings? So it has to be resolved within 45 days before the MOFA release. So if SSF goes out to do a monitoring inspection after the MOFA hits, what does that mean if you've got an unresolved issue?
I'm pretty sure.
I mean, a finding.
This doesn't include a pending audit. Like, if the issue is, okay, we're under investigation because HUD does routine investigations, that would not be a reason to lose points. A finding means somebody investigated the program, found a problem, and the problem hasn't been patched up yet.
But, so, like, in previous inspection or site visits, so SSF goes out and we might have a finding, you know, they provide a letter and it says, we haven't complied with this. So I'm assuming that's considered a finding, right?
It depends on the level of, it depends on where you're deficient. There are certain items that are considered findings that align with what HUD considers to be findings, and then there are certain things
your
that are.
Your question's about a matter of time. Right.
Yeah.
So if it's
right.
within that 45-day threshold and you've had a finding, but you don't have enough time to test the question. So how would that be taken into account when considering?
You didn't have 45 days to even fix it.
Right.
Correct. So if you don't have 45 days to fix it, then that measure wouldn't apply. But if you have 45 days and you still haven't complied, then you would lose points in this area. So that's why it says occurring. So you received the finding more than 45 days prior to the release of the NOFA.
We'll take the date the NOFA was released. We'll go back 45 days. And if you got your finding letter during that time frame, then it's not subject to this ranking. And it would be before that date, 45 days before the release of the NOFA, is subject to.
Can we jump to page 4 because I have a concern I want to make sure I get an opportunity to mention?
I'd like to.
So I question the lack of points that transitional housing gets, even if it's dedicated to youth. And it would be nice to see an even amount for transitional housing as for either permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing. If the transitional housing was serving one of the two priority populations of youth or domestic violence survivors. When we're talking about transitional housing for youth, once again, it's kind of out of the typical box a little bit. So it's that question, that concern comes up.
Okay, let's take a step back and do an overview of the whole measure on page 4. And then I think that's certainly the kind of amendment that could be put through right now if that's something that the advisory board wants. So the design of this measure is meant to help give extra points to programs that are meeting HEARTH priorities by serving high needs populations. Right? It's another way of making sure that we're not giving the highest points to the programs that are taking the easy way out. So the cost measure gives a couple of points, maybe in some future competition, literally 2 points, if you've got good cost efficiency. This measure gives 10 points right now, up to 10 points, to programs that are serving high needs populations. And the structure is that you would get 2 or 4 or 6 points based on your program type. And then you could accumulate a series of 2-point bonuses up to a total of 10 points for each high needs population that you're serving. And the test for whether you're serving it is, are you dedicating or prioritizing at least half of your new placements for that population? So.
So, and Catherine and Sarah, please add on. We three of us and maybe others sit on the performance review committee, and I feel really strongly to say that this was this category was one that we were not in agreement on, and actually what we wanted and what we are striving to get to is a gaps analysis to say our system has this type of intervention, and our gap, our need related both to population and to housing intervention is X. So we want to reward programs that are providing that gap. We are unable to, I think the discussion we just had here in this room about data reflects on the challenges we faced. We were unable to get to that. So our hope still remains that between the mid-year and the final, this will be revised to reflect a true gap rather than what these are, what Harth says are important, but we don't know, we are not able to substantially say this is what our community needs more of or less of in a competitive situation when we have to make judgments of either changing our programs, whether an existing program or new program. So I just wanted to say that because I think there's a lot wrapped in this, and I just wanted to put it out there that I think the committee's goal was that this is not probably where we'll hopefully land on.
And the work we're doing, ABC, and
they're working on it,
should give you that gap analysis.
I have a specific concern about the ranking of permanent supportive housing at a 4 versus a 6, when it's specifically designed to serve the folks that are most in need, and when analyzing the BIs for that, those are the folks that are for permanent supportive housing or those most in need. And using the data that we do have available, such as this report that we received today, more than half of the individuals qualify for permanent supportive housing, and those individuals accumulate more than each of the individual families if we're looking at the production of units specifically and not people necessarily. So I would like to understand a bit more about the justification for permanent supportive housing being ranked below rapid rehousing.
Sure. The thought there is not to express any preference for rapid rehousing over permanent supportive housing. The thought is that permanent supportive housing is mostly required to serve chronically homeless populations and is often well designed to serve many other high needs populations, whereas rapid rehousing may not be as good of a match for chronically homeless populations. And so after adding the 2-point bonuses, a typical permanent supportive housing project would probably score at least as high as a typical rapid rehousing project.
For the 10-point cap, the amount of points you would have in that category.
Yes.
Erin, and then Diane.
So I'm going to follow up on Jen, because there's if you're serving, like we are, a seriously mentally ill population of chronically homeless adults in permanent supported housing, the universe of possibility is only 8 points. It's not 10 points. So that's a concern. And so if the permanent supported housing points were 6, then it would be equal. So that's my point.
And if I do the math for transitional housing for Tay, it kind of comes up at 4. Kind of seems pretty low.
Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. So,
I have a random, it's actually random, it kind of goes along with that transitional housing. You guys know that, well, the idea when you're looking at the lack of housing, that exists for homeless population is there. So I'm thinking, you know, anytime anyone's providing, you know, transitional housing or any one of these categories, it's a benefit to the overall continuum of care. So why even give lower scores at all? Because the issue is to get them placed so that you can work with them, move forward into other issues. Into, you know, housing that's sustainable on their own because they're working, they're doing different things. That's the ultimate goal. So that would be my comment in general. Because I deal with a lot of people in recovery, and you know, I'd like to see them not return, because I figure if you're addicted, you're high, you're drunk, or you have a good chance of going back. So that's who we don't want come back on the street, right? So that's my perspective.
Thank you.
I think there's a lot of good discussion to be had by going through the points and all of the different factors in this document. And we're 15 minutes over on our meeting, and I'd like to ask that we move the approval of this to April if we can. I don't know if that allows that, if you're allowed on your timeline. Otherwise, because we're losing people, and which changes the information in our discussion. What is likelihood?
We need to take action today, just for the timeline, so that we can make sure we get this out.
Yeah. Without an approval, there will be no mid-year review this year.
Right.
Oh. Okay. So the scoring can change before the final.
That's correct.
Though. And so I think part of the goal of the mid-year review was, let's see what happens for projects in this process, and let's see what feedback we get from providers in this, so that hopefully by the time that the performance review committee has to make the final scoring decisions, we will have the gaps analysis and we will have the feedback from all of the providers on the impacts of this scoring tool, and we can more fully assess the concerns of it and adjust the scoring accordingly. We had to start somewhere. We clearly have a very strict timeline. I don't think any member of the performance review committee was entirely happy with this. Some of us are actually really concerned about the implications of the different scoring, but we have to draw a line and say, this is what we have at this point. We hope to fix some of this.
So are you saying essentially that you want us to take a look at the actual factors without scores on them today? I'm not clear what you said.
We have to adopt something today. Nobody's totally happy with these factors or necessarily the scoring that goes along with them, but because we have to do something now, the mid-year review gives the Performance Review Committee an opportunity to see how this shakes out, what concerns arise from this, and some additional time to get some additional data to make better informed decisions on the final scoring tool. And so we ultimately thought that it would be helpful to have the provider feedback on these items so that we could adjust the final scoring tool.
Okay.
It's easier to provide feedback when you know the points.
David, then Kathy, then John.
So that's my question. So this can be adjusted later on?
Yes.
Because obviously by design, some of our programs automatically can't get 10. I don't care what you really do. Okay, so.
Kathy, and then John.
And this review, the midterm review, is an internal process, correct? This doesn't go to HUD. It's designed for us to be able to make a sort of assessment of how existing programs would score if this is the system that we use.
Yes, and it also gives us an opportunity to provide TA for areas where programs may be struggling. And it's a good practice that we'll write about in our COC application to say we have a year-round performance review. We conduct thorough mid-year review. So
what will go to HUD is a copy of this scoring tool saying that we held this mid-year review. And should there be a project that does not meet minimum score, and then the advisory board or executive committee recommends that it not be renewed, that information of how they scored on this tool will then go to HUD as part of the COC application.
So I just had a follow-up on that, so I'm sorry. So if we have to vote on it today, it does seem like for some folks there are some really legitimate, significant remaining concerns, and I don't know if there's a way to approve it with a commitment to work to address those issues and bring it back prior to when it becomes finalized or something, because it does seem like these are real issues that it's hard to say, yes, go ahead and do it, not knowing how those things would play out for some of our most significant providers.
John,
and then Diane.
Yeah. This is our first year to do the, this is the first year we've tried to do a mid-year review, and it follows on a couple of years of talking through the idea that the way performance review worked was pretty unsatisfactory, that we kept coming up to situations where it was all very for real and people felt like they were getting screwed by the system. And this is a way to really look at it ahead of time. Nobody thought this would be a perfect, you know, deal where everyone would be thrilled with, you know, going in, that every answer would already be known before we got there. This is a way to raise questions, I think. I think we need to top this right now. But I think if you could just talk through how the mid-year review is going to work, just give us, or whoever's supposed to say that. I think maybe we should have started with that, but just talk through kind of how it works.
If I could, just so we can maybe have one summarization. Kate and Diane.
So I heard Kimberly say that there's programs that have to meet a threshold minimum, and I wondered if you've established that minimum score so that we would know if our programs have to.
So I can't remember offhand what that minimum number is. I don't know if you know, Michelle, but it is in the rank and review materials that go out every year. They're currently in the portal from FY16. Yeah. That
would
the instructions
mid-year?
But if they've changed,
so we would know every year if we were in the portal.
Yes. So what I'm saying is the general instructions for the way the process works has a minimum number in it. And I can't remember offhand exactly what that is, so we can upload that document into FY17, but you can find it right now in FY16, FY15. It's out there for everyone to view.
And it would be the same number.
Correct.
So I think we absolutely need to support the mid-year review piece. It sounds so important, and I think the gaps piece sounds really important to continue to look at that piece to make it, I think, a more accurate tool. But is there some way to mark this tool as it's like preliminary or it's the first, you know, go round? I mean, a draft doesn't quite seem like the right term, but I'm not coming up with the right word. But I think there's some way. I mean, this isn't the hard and fast tool yet, and it's a lot easier to approve it if we know that it's in a changing process.
What you can do, I would think, is when a motion is made to use that wording, and then we would take the motion from there, I would think.
So this would be marked as mid-year.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to a couple of questions that have come to you. What you're being asked to approve today is the tool that will be used for the mid-year process, and we absolutely will be coming back and asking for approval of the tool that will be used for the actual NOPA as well.
And future mid-year processes.
For next year, yes. So moving forward, we'll bring the mid-year tool here, we'll ask you to approve it, and we'll use it. Then when the NOFA is released, you'll also have an opportunity to approve the actual real tool that will be used for that competition, for sure. And then in terms of how the mid-year review will work, that is something that the home base team can describe. And then in terms of the gaps analysis, we're working with ABT to complete that process, and there will be opportunity both at the funders group and at community meetings for everyone to weigh in on that process as well.
So I think this will go with how you're going to describe how this is going to work, but if you could clarify what Kimberly said, which was it'll get approved, then it'll be used, the project will be ranked. If they fail, then you report it to HUD?
Right.
That's my question. Yeah.
No. So, yeah. So, if they do not score the minimum or if they have incurable deficiencies, that will then come to either the Executive Leadership Committee or this body to then make a recommendation that that project not be allowed to compete in the process. But any project that the COC decides not to reallocate has to be reported to HUD during the COC application process. So it's not going to be reported now.
Decision whether or not they're going to accept an application during our local competitive process. If that occurs, if this body reviews this tool, has this thorough conversation, 30 minutes over time, and we decide that
that project is not going to be accepted for the local competition. At that point, it would be passed on to HUD with this information and the decision-making.
But not like next month,
no.
In August or whenever the NOFA is due.
And the intent of the mid-year review is to give projects an opportunity to improve before
right.
the
correct.
Not to leave projects out of competing.
So Jen and then Trish.
Just to be crystal clear, it sounds like a low-ranking or non-compliant project based on the year review could be recommended not to be able to apply for the NOFA. So this does have real potential impact for programs. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it would give evidence to this body for review to make that decision.
Okay.
It's not a
which
pass or fail.
It matters.
Not to
it
come
comes here,
back here.
Right.
It's pass or fail. Comes back here, and then this committee
has that conversation.
Has that conversation.
Yep.
And it sounds like Kimberly said, if a program is identified, if a program fails and is identified with incurable deficiencies, that means.
That means
that the
that
program can control or things that the COC can control?
So sort of both. For example, if a project says they don't want to participate in Housing First, well, that's a curable deficiency, but if they choose just to say, no, we're not going to be a Housing First project, then that will have to go up for reallocation based on our scoring tool. Now, if there's something that can be fixed and the project agrees to fix it, then that measure would be met and they would be able to move forward.
So that's where some of the concerns in the numbers. So just by virtue of the way the numbers have been structured that people have concerns about, if that becomes an issue for a particular program, that could be considered
so
curable.
So an incurable deficiency would be something like one of the projects that was not funded last year, we found in their data that they entered folks that did not qualify for the program. At that point, you cannot cure that because you have to clean out the entire program and start over. So that is really in the time frame, in the spirit of the competition, it was put to reallocation. Because, again, that project chose to enter those folks that didn't qualify for the program at the time.
David.
No, I'll answer that.
Okay.
These threshold factors that we meet, we aren't going to have to, again, meet them when the NOFA hits, right? We're doing this so that we aren't having to scramble again last minute to get everything together.
Correct. And that's why threshold, everyone's already turned everything in, and those have been reviewed once by the Rank and Review Committee, and we're in the process of following up with projects if they're missing some small details. Some of these other measures, we're going to wait till the end of the month to run the data because that will be the exact time frame that will be run again in June for the NOFA. Does that make sense?
So, at what point should we work with SSF to resolve issues that we've had with getting our referrals from poor data entry? Because my understanding is that we're going to have to show documentation that we've requested referrals and not received them. When should that be happening so we don't get dinged on this year?
So again, at the end of the month, we'll run that utilization report so it has the entire time frame. If your utilization report shows that you have low utilization, then you'll have the opportunity to explain that. One of the things that Andrew and I have committed to doing is going back through all of the emails and everything to find any requests that were made so that we can make an educated conclusion there. And then if we have nothing, we'll come to the provider and ask for the information.
We have kept our emails, so I just want to hear if you would bump them first.
Well,
that'd be helpful.
You can start putting them together.
Okay. Yes. Sorry, I just wanted to say a more sort of global thing and about where I think the Performance Review Committee is hoping to go. I mean, I think that, and one of the reasons from my standpoint, the gaps analysis is so important because without that, we're back where we've been for years, which is saying, I mean, it's a natural inclination. I'm doing it too. I'm doing math in my head too, and I'm not a provider. Oh, how is such and such project going to score? And how do we fix this so that such and such project scores well? We need to move to a system where we're not trying to design a tool for a particular project or projects, but for the system. And I think that I am nervous as a performance review committee member that we're not there yet, we're getting there, and I'm happy to hear that we're getting there, but that there's going to be a rift between what happens in the interim, which is still very project-specific, project-centered, to something that is hopefully more systems-centered. And so I don't know how to, I mean, it's just sort of a comment, but I think that from my standpoint, my goal is that this will shift, maybe not substantially in terms of numbers and points, but it will shift substantially in terms of philosophy, and that all of you who are providers will feel that between April and whenever the real NOFA is. And I don't know how to make that better or different, but I just want that out there. I don't know.
David?
And I just have one last comment. It's kind of going across the whole, as a continuum, when do we, and I know it's a tough question, say that we're not in line with Summit Heart's goals, and it's just kind of what, even though these are the goals that they're asking for, as some of the projects that we are losing are just not fitting into this box, and that's the bigger question. How do we find funding in such a tight, and I know that, you know, we have a limited amount of money and we're trying to do this, but at a certain level, we are losing some fabulous programs to a system which 5 years from now, they may say, yeah, that wasn't the greatest, you know, idea, and it's just so that's just a comment.
And it's a good one.
I respectfully request that one of the board members put up a motion.
Well, I thought I asked the question if you could describe what the mid-year review process is, and I haven't heard that answer yet.
Sure.
And Michelle thought you'd be the one who would give us that.
Yeah, happy to. So the mid-year review process is very similar to the NOFA review process. The thought is we will collect an annual performance report from each program. We will send a supplemental questionnaire to each program that will ask them for some short answers and some additional data that doesn't come up in the standard HUD reports. We will convene a panel of non-conflicted members of the community to look at the results of that data and the answers to those questions after they've been processed and pre-digested a bit by our web application, Presto, which takes the sometimes illegible data that we get from HUD and turns it into a more illustrated, graphically designed report that's a little easier on the eye, makes it easier to find the parts of the report that are interesting to the rank and review panel. They have a discussion about each program. They try and see, has the program met each of these scoring factors, and if so, why? They use their discretion to assign a score to each program for each of the scoring factors. The web application then automatically totals up all of the scores that are assigned by the panel, and if there's a need to ask questions of a representative of one of the programs, that can be done. And then finally, the rank and review panel comes up with a ranked list that reflects the scores that were assigned. Not necessarily exactly, but it's meant to correspond to the scores. Then that ranked list comes here for the approval or modification by the advisory board.
So the piece of that I guess I thought there was more interaction with each program as the information was developed. I mean, like to go back to Aaron's point about the 3-day thing and stuff. And I don't really hear that that's really what happens here. It just mimics the final.
Right, can you talk though, specifically about what happens with what you learn in the mid-year review for the purpose of delivering PA to providers and doing the feedback and all that part of it? What's different than the review, the formal review of rank?
So once the rank and review has been completed and the list is published, then each provider will receive a report that shows their score and any deficiencies they had, and then recommendations from Homebase and SSF staff will work together to make recommendations for technical assistance on any of those points where anywhere where you lost points.
And staff would be providing that technical assistance.
Right. Depending on what we learn, if everyone does poorly in a particular area, we may do a convening. If different projects have different kinds of problems, then that'll be more custom with your agency. So
So what happens? So, like, let's say we score low and we wouldn't get funded, and then you work with us, right? And so we fix it. So are we going to get rescored again, and then we would get put back on the list for funding?
You would be rescored during the actual NOPA competition.
But if it needs to come to this board for approval, how does that timing work if you don't rescore it?
I actually don't think we're going to approve the mid-year ranked list, but we will bring it here so that folks can see where projects land and what we're doing to assist them, because it wouldn't make actually.
That's where we go back to the curable and incurable deficiencies and the willingness to participate in technical assistance.
So is there an appeals process if you, if some, you, whatever you is, decides that it's incurable? I mean, can the group that is told they're incurable have a chance to appeal that? Yeah.
We can add that to the process.
This seems logically we would, because our point is to help our programs to be more effective.
I would say that if we had this process, going back to CERNA, this is where it kind of stems from, we would not have lost our program.
Right.
We had this, because we would know,
right,
what we're saying, we get the score, and we would come back and say, hey, we lost X amount of points, and it was a curable one, obviously. We could fix that.
It would depend. In that situation, my recollection was, it was, are you serving chronically homeless, but the list that you got your referrals from, you really didn't have the ability to change that. I don't know that it would change that score.
But we could have at that point, we could have said the assistance could be, because of that, that's out of our control, we are going to lose X amount of points. We need to be able to pull from a different population of people, or specifically get those that would be
in line. Yeah, you would have to change your...
Well, but the way that you receive your referrals currently, that's not a possibility.
But I mean, there's two programs that get the same referrals, so how can you have two identical programs that get the same referrals with two different answers? I mean, one of them has to be wrong.
But yeah, on the appeals, typically, was there any data provided that was inaccurate or that wasn't reviewed, if I memory serves me? It's not to make the case to change the minds of the review.
Mr. Secretary, with the understanding that the intention is to provide technical assistance based on this information, I move that we move ahead with the mid-year review.
So we have a motion on the table. Do we have a second? Second, Patty. We do have a second. Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. Meeting.
I said,
In and Patch was designed to be
Okay, so we held sort of providers that
and then, I have since done it to kind of clarify where I could. Because some of them, so yeah, she does have a bonus.
I'm sorry.